Well, same where it should be.
This is the Senate Judiciary Committee right meeting in hearing room B. Today is June 5th. Today is both a work session and a public hearing, and it will begin at 5 p.m. The work session is on the following bills. Senate Bill 123, 250, 661, and House Bill 2002, 2160, 2304, 2384,
and
2641. That concludes the work session. Then the public hearing scheduled for the following bills: House Bill 2007, 2016, 2205, 2259, 2314, 2453, 2484, 2730,
this one goes on the
and 2914.
Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order at 5:01 p.m. Senator Frye of Subcommittee 1 to hear public testimony, and I'll take up House Bill 2453.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rex Armstrong, appearing on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union in support of House Bill 2453. I have for the committee copies of a letter that I sent to Representative Springer, in which I asked him to introduce this bill, explaining why the criminal defamation bill, statute in this state violates Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution. That provision is ORS 163.605. There are two cases that directly support that conclusion. One is Wheeler versus Green, in which the Oregon Supreme Court in 1970, I'm sure you are, held that you can't get punitive damages for defamation. So to make defamation criminal is also a violation of the same prohibition in the Constitution against punishing that type of expression. In dictum, in State versus Robertson, in a footnote, the court made the same point by saying that criminal libel, which is what criminal defamation is not a crime which survived adoption of Article 1, Section 8. So I really see this as a housekeeping measure where this provision has been on the books for a long time. It's rarely, if ever, been enforced. I think the last case I could find an example of any effort to prosecute was in the 1960s. There, the Oregon Supreme Court found insufficient evidence. There was no apparent constitutional challenge at the time. But I think given the Oregon Supreme Court's analysis of Article 1, Section 8 and the decisions in Robertson and Wheeler versus Green, this statute should simply be repealed.
With Davidson versus Rogers, it was wrong we decided, you know that.
It may well have been. It's the concurrence language that I'm relying on.
I argued that in the Supreme Court. Supreme Court chose to follow Holden versus Pioneer Broadcasting Company, which is also wrongly decided.
I remember now that case, yes.
And as a result, we still have that unconstitutional retraction statute in Chapter 30.
Yes.
Oh, well. Okay?
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is that an innovation in law?
Yes. Well, all right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2453, and we'll move to that's on a work session. No, where is it? 24. Oh. Well, we better get him in here then, because I was going to take that one up next, but that's the only...
Okay.
That's the city. Why don't you do that? I'll take it up.
Go get it.
Wait a minute. Hold on just a second. Just wait a minute. I'll take the 22.
Which is
Here he is. Okay. Okay, we will proceed with House Bill 2484. Can't say we're not accommodating that.
Very nice. We appreciate that the other judiciary committee is still going. I'm taking a quick break.
Mr. Chair, Council, good afternoon. Appreciate the opportunity to testify first on House Bill 2484, which I believe is a very important piece of legislation that will correct a wrong that, in part, that is imposed on individuals who are victims of crime in our society. Presently, if a person needs general public assistance, who is disabled, whether it's disabled assistance or medical assistance resulting from a crime committed against him or her, the state has a claim against the person's estate for the amount of assistance the state has paid. The state also has a claim against the crime victim's surviving spouse of the state if the crime victim's estate cannot satisfy the debt. 2484 would prevent the state from making any claims against the estates of crime victims or the estates of victims' surviving spouses if the reason for their inability to work is that he or she is a crime victim. The bill is very narrowly written in this area. The bill declares that such claims defeat the general purposes of the public assistance law. So I urge your yay vote in support of this measure. Mr. Sharp, who is a crime victim himself and is incapacitated directly as a result of the crime, is here to also to testify on this measure.
All right, fine. Appreciate your comments. You're in a Judiciary Committee meeting now?
Yes. We're having a work session on some Senate bills.
Going on right now. The Senate has a floor session going on, so I keep expecting a knock on the door for me. Did you want to stay while the other witnesses testify, or do you want to leave?
If it's okay, I could leave.
Yeah, I'm fine.
And if
all
you
right.
have
well,
further...
I'll see that this gets on a work session. No. Let's see, we're having... is it a work session on Friday or hearing?
Both.
Well, anyway, we'll.
Okay. If there are any questions, the council can contact my office and we'll be glad to try to answer those questions before your work session.
It'll have my personal attention.
Thank you.
Now, I've got two witnesses who didn't write down their addresses on here, and the committee has a rule that if you don't write down your address, you can't testify, but I'll waive the rule in this case. And I've got Dennis and Marvin. Now, do you want to come up together or separately? All right. Gentlemen, come on up.
Senator Price, I didn't catch the names.
You didn't get the names? We'll have them state their names.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Dennis Scharf.
How do you spell that? S-C-H-A-R-F?
Correct.
All right, fine, thank you.
Address is 4415 60th Avenue, Northeast Salem.
Okay.
And being a victim of a crime and receiving public assistance, this bill has my complete support, for sure.
Okay.
I hope that it's just a beginning of recognizing the problems that victims of crime do have, one of many. And because of the act of a person with a gun in their hand, my ability to continue making a living has just been completely taken away. Everything I've worked for over 20 years is gone. I can't even leave an estate to the two daughters that I have.
Well, now, are you receiving some victim's compensation now?
That was used up in about 20 days.
I see. Well, okay. And so this bill actually wouldn't help you at the present time, then, would it? It would help others, though.
What it would do is, at the time of my death, my understanding is, would stop public assistance from going back on my estate to recover any cash assistance. Cash assistance only, because at age 65, then they go from cash and also medical and so on. And I don't feel that I'm going to make it to age 65 anyway, so I'm not too worried about that. But what it does is, I think it kind of relieves the spouse if I were to marry. I don't feel it's reasonable to ask somebody that I married to take care of a bill that I have incurred because of the act of the criminal. I just don't feel that that's fair. Okay. And even if I were to be able to put the money away, I'm only allowed to have up to $1,600 anyway, so we're not talking about a lot of money. There's no way that I could buy a house or have real estate with the income that I have now, so.
Okay, I appreciate that. Now, you'll have to be patient because I've just got a call. I have to go to the floor of the Senate. And I'll be back just as soon as I can get here, and we'll proceed. I'm afraid that that may happen three or four times tonight before we get through up there. Anyway, the committee's in recess. Well, I go. Senator Brockman is present, and we'll continue with the public hearing on 2484. And Mr. Scharf, were you through or not through?
Well, you had asked the question if this bill would help do anything for me right now.
Yeah.
No, it would only ease my mind as far as the time of death.
Okay, fine. All right, sir, go ahead.
I'm Marvin Reese, 1121 Fur Street South is my address. I'm a member of the Citizens for Justice and Crime Victims United. I work at the prison. I've been there for 20 years come Friday. They let me out over the weekend. But, I'm in favor of this bill, and I wish your concurrence on this. This another case where the criminal justice system or the system itself makes the crime victim another victim in the same system. So this might help alleviate some of the problems that the crime victims have in the
All
future.
Right.
I would like to say one last thing. Public assistance is the last place I want to be. I mean, that's not something, but I don't feel that I have any other option than to be there. So
right.
I want to make that perfectly clear.
Good. Well,
if I could hold down a full-time job and support myself, I definitely would do it.
Sure. Okay, well, appreciate it. Any questions from the committee members? Okay, gentlemen, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
2730. Now, where are we? 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. That's going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2484, and we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2730. Representative Whitty.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jim Whitty, District 47, Western Douglas, Northern Coos. I'm the chief sponsor of House Bill 2730, which puts a little teeth into something that needed some teeth in it for the last, I'd say, at least 3 years. This is something akin to what was going on with the installation of solar energy devices in homes in the 83 session, where there were people wandering around selling people solar devices that have worked or didn't work or partially worked, and so the state decided to do something about seeing that those people were competent, and it was a consumer protection situation. The same thing is the case here with satellite earth stations. The state under the Department of Commerce currently has a method for licensing people who install these devices, and then that's as far as it goes. If there are people out there, and there are, that are installing these technical devices, then without a state license, there's nothing that the state can do to make sure that they are licensed, and to see that the consumers, that are people that are buying these devices, are protected. These devices are currently selling for somewhere around $2,400 up to $3,000, depending on the sophistication. I happen to own one. I've had one for 3 years. I live out in the country, 20 miles from the Coos Bay, and about 15 miles from the end of the cable. I've had every kind of a problem with it you can ever have. I've been, and mainly because of just ignorance. I mean, nobody knew. I got one about the third one, I think, that was installed. The thing has never spanned properly. I was told that I had to put in a concrete slab in a certain spot because that was where the 70 degree span would allow the dish to span, and then found out that it was in the wrong place, and in order to put it there, I would have to fall a 200-year-old myrtle tree, which I did, but very reluctantly. There are 17 satellites up there. It's easy to set up a dish and center it on one satellite and bring it in. But then, if it isn't set properly so that it will span all 17 as it turns in that 70-degree cycle that it turns, not cycle, but quadrant, it will run over the top of the other satellites and run under these, and then you'll get mainly this one, and maybe the one on each side and the others don't come in. It's very difficult to do that. I also bought a device that turns it automatically, since my wife is disabled, from inside the house so that the thing turns. It's 250 feet from the house. The one that I got was supposed to do the job. Turned out it wasn't powerful enough to turn after $685, the weight of this thing. So now I've got another one out there. The guy that I bought the original one from left it at his house. I picked it up, and it's sitting at home waiting to be installed while he's off I don't know where. I had a neighbor call me here not long back. He had one put in. The guy put it in on a Saturday. The thing didn't work properly. Tried to get the guy. He was in a tavern downtown. The guy didn't have a license, we found out. It's a mess.
What kind of a license do they need to do that?
Just a license from the state that says that they are competent to install these things. And there is a test that they have to take, and I don't know how sophisticated the test is, but in this is the Satellite TV Week that I get every week. It has a programming guide in it, and I noticed this little short article in there on the May 19th issue, which says, more professionalism in installation and maintenance of satellite TV home units is predicted from the decision by the Electronics Technicians Association International, ETAI, to license journeyman certified electronics technicians. Ron Crow's spokesman said that because of the large number of satellite installations throughout the country, ETA-1 has developed an exam to certify technicians as to their knowledge in this unique field. And then it gives a contact address. It is my hope that the Department of Commerce will work with this kind of a group to see that the people that do that job are competent to do it. And I would say that way over half of the ones out there now can't do the job competently. And I might say that the earth stations are becoming more and more technical and more difficult to install as time goes on. That's the end of my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care now. Did you get let's see. I'm 2730. Is there any other witnesses? Yep. 2730.
No, a whole bunch.
Are there any other witnesses on House Bill 2730 here? Okay, come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Elaine Day. I'm the administrator of consolidated boards with the Department of Commerce. One of those consolidated boards is Television and Radio Service Advisory Board. This bill contains two provisions. The advisory board supports this bill. The bill contains two main provisions. One is the civil penalty authority to enable the board to stop the unlicensed activity. The second is a minimum standard for written contracts. The board in the last year has received 160 or has followed up on 160 unlicensed activities by unlicensed persons. We currently license 530 licensed people, but yet we had 160 unlicensed activities going on out there that we knew about.
Currently, licensed for what now?
They are licensed for electronic entertainment equipment repair, which includes televisions, radios, satellite antennas.
Installation as well as repair.
Right. We currently, our only authority is through the local district attorney. And in an effort to find out what we could do to better enforce this, we sent a questionnaire to all 36 district attorneys asking them if they would prosecute, and what did we need to do to assist them in that. Out of the 36, we got one response that said, take it to civil court. Six that said, maybe if we have enough money or staff. 14 that said, yes, they would, but they put such prohibitive requirements on it, we could not comply anyway. One that said, yes, they would. Two that said, no, they wouldn't. And 12 that just plain did not respond. So out of 36, we in essence got one that said, yes, they would. When that's our only recourse of enforcing the licensing law, we feel that this is our only recourse as far as helping us bring the unlicensed people into compliance to prevent the problems that Representative Woody was talking about. The second part of this bill is a requirement that all sales and installation of satellite antenna systems have to be done subject to a written contract, and that the board would adopt minimum standards for that written contract. If the installation was done not subject to the written contract, it could not be enforced in court.
Now say that last part again.
If the work was not done subject to a written contract, it could not be enforced in court by the installer.
That's a part of the bill here.
Yes.
So that's a little bit like the law that prevents a builder from collecting for work if he isn't licensed with the builder's board. Are you familiar with that law or not?
Yes, I am. We have the same provision when Mr. Swank was in legislative council. He drafted the same provision for the landscape contractors board, in which the board established minimum standards, which were just common sense standards, such as, you know, name and address of the consumer, name and address of the person doing the work. Is there a guarantee? If so, it has to be stated. What's the work to be done and what's the price? Things that the consumer should ask in the first place but doesn't always, but it's not something so technical that the individual cannot comply. The service dealer has to go to an attorney to for each work job that he does. It's worked very well with landscape contractors, and that's why when Representative Woody contacted me with this problem, this is why I suggested this provision to him.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, thanks. Are there any other witnesses on House Bill 2730? All right, I'm going to close.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I was contacted this afternoon by a couple individuals who are planning to be here. One is driving over from Redmond, but did not anticipate that he could arrive before probably 6:30.
Before when?
6:30.
That's probably going to be too late.
Okay.
We're really in a jam with floor sessions and things. But anyway, for the time being, I'll say House Bill 2730 is closed in terms of a public hearing. Does anyone want to appear on House Bill 2314? There's no one signed up on it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Council.
That bill is a very simple bill. It would increase the membership on the Commission of the Judicial Branch to 15, and the two additions that would be made would be one senior judge and one lawyer with substantial trial experience. Mm-hmm. It also changes the number of members required for a quorum from 8 to 9.
All right. Let's see. Senator Warris, do you have any problem with 2314?
Well, it wasn't in the bill that we passed a budget on.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't suppose there's really that much extra expense involved, is there? We got two people that'll be attending meetings?
Two people will just be the per diem and small amount of mileage.
Okay. Well, then we'll move on.
I can tell you who the two people are if you want it for the hearing.
I think we'll close the public hearing on 2314 then. Now, we've taken care of four bills, 2314, 2453, 2484, and 2730. Yes, 2314, 2453, 2484, and 2730. And we will go to 2259 next. Diana got one.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Diana Godwin from Portland, representing the Oregon State Bar. House Bill 2259 was put in by the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee at the request of the Professional Liability Fund of the Bar Association. The purpose of the bill is to make some clarifying amendments in the existing statutes that govern the Professional Liability Fund to clarify that the fund is responsible for covering any claims made against lawyers who actually work and practice in the state of Oregon. One of the problems that we see out there in the near future is a lawyer who is an active member of the Oregon State Bar but is not practicing, does not have his or her principal office in Oregon. And the problem is that the Professional Liability Fund is not set up to cover those lawyers. And as you may be aware, both the Ninth Circuit and most recently the United States Supreme Court has struck down residency requirements for admission and practice, or for admission to a bar and practice in a state, such that we could anticipate that lawyers who are members of the Oregon State Bar, active members, are paying their active dues, but practicing in New York or California or wherever, could then come in and purchase coverage through the Professional Liability Fund, because, as you're aware, in some states it's very expensive or difficult to purchase professional liability insurance, malpractice insurance, purchase the insurance here in Oregon to cover claims made in connection with their law practice in New York or California. And that would present a very great problem. Number one, the Professional Liability Fund is not set up as an insurance company, and it's not authorized to write premiums for, you know, any lawyer in the country, even though they may be an active member of the bar. This bill does nothing more than clarify that the PLF covers lawyers whose principal offices are in Oregon. It does one other thing. It was an amendment made on the House side, and it clarifies what the Professional Liability Fund has been doing all along in terms of retaining or employing their own legal counsel or retaining outside legal counsel to represent claims made against the fund. This was just, again, that was a question left over after the Attorney General's opinion. Attorney General's aware of this amendment. He does not support it. He does not oppose it. He understands the Professional Liability Fund has always retained its own lawyers, so we thought we'd go ahead and clarify that in statute. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Lester Rawls would be happy to come down for the work session if the committee has any questions.
Didn't we do just about the opposite of what this bill does? Didn't we require?
No, we did not succeed in getting a bill passed last session. There was some issue in connection with that, and I don't recall specifically what happened on that.
Well, the person.
Oh, I know. It was active members of the state bar. I think there was an issue about that.
Okay. What about an active member of the Oregon State Bar who's also an active member of the Washington State Bar, and his office is in Vancouver?
Right.
Now, course, professional liability insurance would be required of him?
No, he's not required to purchase it unless he's practicing law in Oregon.
Well, I mean, he comes over from Vancouver and goes into the Multnomah County Circuit Court, for example, and that kind of thing.
And he practices. Yes, he would be required to have insurance, and in that case, the fund would cover his work in Oregon. That one's a little bit unclear. I've talked to Mr. Rawls about that issue, and they're adopting some administrative rules to determine at what point a person is required to purchase the coverage and at what point then the fund is mandated to provide, to defend a claim. Yes, this is happening more, as you know, with lawyers who are members of the bar in both states. What we want to prevent, obviously, is having to cover lawyers in other states for their practice in other states.
Yes, but if the member of the Oregon Bar who has a principal office in Vancouver, Washington, where he also practices law...
At the football game where he was in the bowl game, people thought he was intoxicated. He didn't drink. I don't think.
It was just deja vu fever.
Yeah, it was just after he'd gotten all his problems with cranberry juice.
That's what he was drinking.
Excuse
me. A man don't try.
Okay, any other questions? All right, fine. Now, we have Toby Graffs here and Mildred Cormack, and I guess you're going to have to be next.
Senator Frey, members of the committee, my name's Toby Graff. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, specializing in appellate work. And I'm appearing here to urge the adoption of HB 2205 with the amendments proposed by the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Bar. I won't repeat the earlier testimony. I would like to emphasize a couple of points. The main problem, of course, has been that a party who fails to serve, an appellant who fails to serve, a party who appeared below will automatically have his appeal dismissed once that fact, the service defect, is brought to the attention of the court. The Section 5 of 2205 attempts to ameliorate or mitigate the effects of a service defect by giving the appellant an alternative. Either he can serve everybody who appeared below, or he can serve those persons he designates as adverse parties in his notice of appeal. There used to be similar statutory requirement in 1973 of serving all adverse parties. It generated a tremendous amount of litigation in trying to determine who was adverse and who wasn't. And indeed, that litigation was one of the factors that led the legislature in 1973 to dispense with the requirement of serving adverse parties and replace it with the requirement of serving everybody who had appeared below. What I'm fearful of is that Section 5, as it presently stands, will be a source for similar litigation. So the bar has proposed that you simply eliminate the jurisdictional requirement of service altogether. Everybody has to be served who appears below, but if someone isn't served, that does not deprive automatically the Court of Appeals of jurisdiction over the appeal. The failure to serve one of the parties would still give the court power to dismiss an appeal upon motion of a party if that party, the moving party, could establish that he'd been prejudiced by the lack of service. So the court has the power to take remedial steps under the bar's proposal, but it no longer would be required automatically to dismiss. The proposed amendment, I submit, simplifies the question of whether the court has jurisdiction, gives the court power to dismiss an appeal where lack of service substantially affects the interest of a party, and should not interfere unduly with motion practice in the Court of Appeals. Today, the rules and statutes require parties to an appeal to take certain steps at certain times, failure of which would be a ground for a motion to dismiss. One way to prevail in such a motion is to show that you've been prejudiced. That's done by affidavit and by argument. The court has experience in dealing with these affidavits and arguments and assessing prejudice. Hence, eliminating the jurisdictional significance of a service defect would simply permit the court to continue with its practice of dismissal upon motion of a party if a prejudice is shown. I urge the committee to adopt the proposed amendments. But in any event, whether it does so or not, I certainly urge the committee to approve of HB 2205.
Okay, thanks. Any questions? Thanks, Toby. Okay, Millard, you've got minus 30 seconds. We'll make them come down and get us. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I don't think I need take much additional time. The previous witnesses have made most of the points that I would like to make. Oh, I beg your pardon. For the record, I'm Mildred Carmack, an attorney in private practice in Portland. I practice in the same firm as Mr. Graff, and like Mr. Graff, I'm an appellate specialist, doing virtually nothing else but appellate work. Just would like to point out to the committee that this bill will eliminate many of the unnecessary complications that have made appellate practice an extremely technical area lately, and with particular reference to the service of the notice of appeal, would support the proposed modifications by the Procedure and Practice Committee. At present, if service of a notice of appeal by my opponent is defective, I must advise my client that we can move to have that appeal dismissed and end the case right there. If I'm correct in that assessment, my opponent's client loses their appeal rights, and sooner or later, same thing is likely to happen to me. With the modifications proposed by the Procedure and Practice Committee, the court will have the power to determine whether defects actually caused any harm, and if not, the parties will have their appeal heard on its merits.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Thanks. Yes, Mr. Nass, come on back. I'd like to have you comment on your viewpoint on those proposed amendments.
The Judicial Department opposes them. Senator Fidley said, what we ought to do here is what really matters. You need to understand, an appeal is from something that's happened in the trial court where somebody has already won. Let's say the plaintiff in a personal injury action, he's already won. He's gone through a trial, all the expense, attorney fees, he's won. What these people are saying is that the loser, the defendant, can file a notice of appeal and not timely serve anybody, not timely serve the plaintiff. The most important person who needs to know whether he's got a final judgment, the plaintiff, they are saying doesn't need timely notice. We submit that it's a matter of fundamental fairness that if nobody else gets served with timely notice, the parties designated by the appellant, not anybody else, the appellant gets to choose who is going to be the adverse party, party of parties. Those parties need to get served as a matter of fundamental fairness. The other issue is that if you say that nobody needs to get served timely, where do you draw the line? Can a notice of appeal be served on a party 2 weeks before oral argument, after oral argument? I mean, the amendments don't address the problem of where do you draw the line.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hickson.
Well, the court could make rules on that, couldn't it?
You could make rules, but that then brings up the other facet of what I was going to say. every time there is a failure to serve someone, there is going to be a motion filed to dismiss that case. And I beg to differ with Mr. Graff, because I'm the one who handles the motions practice, and I can guarantee you that there will be a significant increase in the motions practice, because every time there's a failure to serve, there is going to be a motion to dismiss, and somebody's going to argue that they are prejudiced by it. More often than not, they probably won't be able to make their case, but the court will still have to look at that motion and do all the paperwork that's necessary. All of the horrors that have been recited as the need for dispensing with service of notice on all parties are dealt with by our bill. Our bill doesn't say you have to serve everybody. That's one option. The other option is serve adverse parties only. In none of the cases that have been referred to as thrown out of court because they failed to serve somebody dismissed out of the case 2 years ago would be dismissed under our bill. Under our bill, those parties presumably would not have been designated adverse parties, and if you didn't serve them, no big deal. That's all I have to say.
Dan, thank you. Any questions? Senator Failey?
I was outside, unfortunately. I presume he doesn't have any objection to the bar's amendment.
Any other questions?
All right.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Nansen.
Do you
want
a work session?
Well, I got a note from the president a few minutes ago, and he said, you're late. When are you going to be up there? And I wrote back and said 7:20, so now it's 7:22.
Let's take the bar's amendments
like
and pass
the
bill.
Well, no. Just a minute now.
Let's take the bar's amendments and pass the bill.
I did want to. Well,
how many do you need for quorum?
Well, we need five on a work session.
I mean, for upstairs.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
I'd be happy to.
Unless we weren't going to take the. What do you want to do?
I don't want. I'm not in favor of bar minutes, I guess is the way to put it.
You do want people to lose their appeals.
Yeah.
Not
that's right. I like child pornography and drug dealers, too. You know, all that stuff. We. Yeah, I know that Representative Springer wanted to discuss that with me before we sent it out.
Why were NASA suggesting that he thought better of? The staff know what he was thinking of suggesting that he thought better of.
He didn't have an argument. He didn't have an argument.
Well, he said, I thought about having an argument.
Well, let's see. Here's the thing. I guess I'm going to have to accommodate these people out here with a subcommittee because there are some folks from out of town, and I'll get permission to come back and maybe bring somebody else with me, and we'll continue the public hearing.
Increase
the motion. You've got. I'm going to conclude the public hearing on 2205. We have 2016. Two witnesses from Portland. And we have the 2007 one witness from Portland. Well, we're not going to get to the work session. I would say that there's little hope that we can, unless we want to just adjourn this until the session's over, which will be about 10 o'clock, and come back.
Okay. Do you want to push the work session out until tomorrow?
Protected.
And we're going to have to, I think. Unless the committee members are willing to come back at 10 o'clock and work till midnight or so, well, we'll just have to carry them over till tomorrow. What do you want to do? Do you have enough to do today?
I'll come back until midnight if you want me to.
I would.
Mr. Chairman, I don't need to hear it on 2007. Oh, we can get me later. That helps.
Well, okay. I think that...
I'd like to help get more done, but frankly, that last bill, with the amount of work I've done so far today, it's hard for me to track.
Yeah.
I some of the older members of the committee seem to be tracking better than I am.
I'm going to excuse the committee members to report upstairs, and then if the president doesn't need you can come back, and I'll...
We just phoned the chairman, and we're not going to reconvene until we get there.
All right. Well, let's go up there. That's my plan, anyway. If I have to come back by myself to conclude the public hearing on these other two bills, I'll do it, because I don't want to carry over any public hearings. So I've got...
Are we carrying these over?
Yes, we're going to...
We're going to...
Bill 2016, which amends ORS 46.045 to allow the City of Portland to employ quasi-judicial hearings officers. These hearings officers would be allowed to hold hearings concerning the enforcement of various provisions of the city's charter, ordinances, rules, and regulations. This amendment is designed to remove any doubt concerning the city's ability to use this method for obtaining compliance with its regulations and those regulations which it enforces on behalf of the state. The City of Portland has used a code hearings officer for approximately 20 months. Mr. Schatzer has been employed in that position for the entire time. The position handles approximately 45 cases a month, the majority of which deal with the enforcement of state building codes, including electrical, plumbing, and structural specialty codes. The city also employs a code hearings officer in hearing cases regarding its housing maintenance code, nuisance code, zoning code, and various other codes aimed at the environment or use of land. Over these 20 months, our experience has shown that there has been a substantial rate of compliance in excess of 85%. Once a, quote, complaint is filed with the hearings officer, Mr. Schatzer can provide you with information regarding a specific breakdown of this figure. Furthermore, it is our belief that the use of a code hearings officer is the most efficient and effective way to obtain compliance with the various provisions of the city's code. It has shown itself to be a method with a great deal of punch for the buck. The taxpayers of the City of Portland receive a great return for a minimal cost in terms of obtaining compliance with the various city regulations that the city is empowered to enact and or is required by law to enforce. Prior to the use of the code hearings officer, the city, through the city attorney's office, went to Multnomah County Circuit Court to obtain injunctive relief against various violators of the city's code. Since the city felt that criminal enforcement through the district court of many of its regulations was inappropriate, this judicial method of enforcing the city's code proved to be both time-consuming and expensive. It took not only the city attorney's time and thus money, but also the court's time and money. If our office decided to prosecute cases in front of the circuit court at the same rate they are being brought in front of the city's code hearings officer, the increase in the number of additional cases to the court's docket would possibly require employing one or two more full-time circuit court judges just to hear the city's cases. However, more likely than not, our office would decide not to prosecute as many of the violations, albeit that they would exist. Even given a limited number of cases, the city's use of the courts for enforcement does affect the court's time, its money, and docket. Thus, through the use of the code hearings officer, not only does the city obtain compliance at a minimal cost to its own taxpayers, but it also saves time, money, and effort for the state's judicial system. This does not mean that a party brought before the code hearings officer does not have judicial review. The alleged violator of the city code, or the city for that matter, if it were dissatisfied with the code hearings officer's opinion, could obtain judicial review via the writ of review statutes. In the 20 months Mr. Schatzer has been employed, there have only been two writs filed with the circuit court, both of which have upheld Mr. Schatzer's determination. In conclusion, the city feels very strongly that this method has proven itself to be a valuable addition to its enforcement methodology. Mr. Schatzer, as a code hearings officer, has done a remarkable job in obtaining compliance at a low cost and relieving the judicial system of a certain number of cases and thus leaving more room on the docket for cases where there is no alternative remedy. Both Mr. Schatzer and I welcome your questions and hope that you will see fit to look favorably upon House Bill 2016.
Okay, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Mr. Chairman, I've submitted 15 copies of my remarks to the committee, and unless you want to hear me talk, I would just like to have those stand as my testimony in this matter.
Let's see.
If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Well, yes. Well, let's take a look at on line 17, for example, the phrase grant other relief as may be necessary to enforce and obtain compliance with the charter and ordinances and so forth. Do you contemplate that the hearings officers would be able to grant injunctive relief, for example?
No, that's not currently within the city code, nor is it contemplated to by anyone that I know of.
What about are the civil penalties that may be imposed without limit, or
They are limited under the city code at present time to $500 per day. I believe they would also be limited on in the same respects by the city charter, which also puts a $500 penalty on the thing. May I state that the civil penalties that are currently being used are used quite. Are used quite sparingly. Typically, the civil penalty, when imposed, is suspended on the condition that the violator bring the condition into conformity with the code within a reasonable period of time. I've attached to my testimony, my written testimony there, some statistics about the amounts of penalties that have been imposed and the amounts that have been suspended. And generally speaking, the penalty is not imposed, but rather is waived when the violator brings the situation into compliance.
You have contempt powers?
No. Sometimes I wish I did, but I do not.
Go ahead, counsel. One of the things in the House amendments by the House Judiciary Committee, dated May 15th, the unengrossed amendments, it continues the authority to impose civil penalties and grant other relief as may be necessary to enforce and obtain compliance with the charter. And the chairman has already asked about contempt and those sorts of powers. What other kinds of relief do you grant?
Typically the power to enforce the civil penalty is the ultimate hammer that is used. The violator would be required to correct the condition or bring the situation into compliance with the code. The typical situation is failure to provide inspection or access on building code enforcement type situations. The situation would then be typically the order would be that the respondent in the proceeding would be required to provide the access within a designated period of time. Typically, it runs between 2 weeks and 6 weeks, depending upon the situation involved. And a civil penalty in the amount of $200 would be imposed, suspended on the condition that they do comply. There are some other limited situations where I grant other types of relief. For instance, in the dangerous buildings proceedings under the city charter, under the city code, I am authorized to authorize the city to demolish the structure and make the cost of the demolition a lien against the subject property if that is necessary. Also, the city in certain situations is authorized to go in and take extraordinary measures to relieve imminently dangerous situations, untended excavations, things like this. The procedure the city uses now, except in immediate emergency situations, is to bring it before the hearings officer for authorization for the city to undertake that and to give the person responsible for the problem a chance to appear and be heard.
Mr. Chairman. Go ahead,
counsel. One of the things that the bill, as amended by the House, provides is to the authority to adopt rules and regulations relating to the conduct of the hearings process. Do those include things like standards of proof, levels of evidence?
Yes, they do. The rules are closely modeled after the State Administrative Procedures Act and the Attorney General's model rules. And while there are perhaps minor wording differences, it basically follows the same rules, procedures that are used by the state agencies.
But your review is through the writ of review, and the standard of proof on review is higher than substantial evidence. No, it is substantial evidence.
It is substantial evidence.
It's a substantial evidence test, yeah.
Under the writ of review statute. In fact, when the particular title to the city code, which was the organic legislation for the hearings officer, much of the language, as Mr. Schatz has testified, was taken directly from the state APA. And in terms of the level of proof necessary before Mr. Schatz, we just borrowed the same language that the state APA has. So that's what it was intended to do, basically just provide a quasi-judicial forum for the resolution of what the city perceived of as basically problems of limited interest, basically just to the city, and that would not, that were not really being effectively dealt with in circuit court due to the fact of that the judges there were not, there are some very technical problems dealing with structural codes and electrical codes, and they, it would just take a large-scale, basically, education process to educate them in terms of that, whereas when you have basically a specialized hearings officer who can, who hears these cases day in and day out, he understands the substantive aspects of them, and we, the code itself, the procedural aspects, we felt fully comport with all necessary, and we feel, in fact, we tried to be very conservative with, in terms of due process to ensure that everyone is entitled to notice, and Mr. Schatzer, I think, has even tempered that somewhat by being, by allowing for additional time for people to obtain attorneys if they so desire. They can stop the hearing at any time if they feel that they are getting in over their head. Normally, attorneys are not present at the hearings. If an alleged violator wishes to have an attorney, they can stop the hearing and have an attorney represent them during the pendency of the hearing. And so we think that what this is designed to do is just to save money to the city and save money for the court system.
But there is no requirement in the law that you're proposing, excuse me, that the procedures you adopt comply with the Administrative Procedures Act in Oregon or with anything.
Right? No, the city is not required to do that, but I think that those would be the minimum test if they, if our ordinances were ever challenged in court as whether they were constitutionally sufficient. I think that that would probably be the test that a court would use. And so therefore, since this has already worked, we figured that there was no reason to change it, and it really isn't an onerous burden to follow in the final analysis at any rate.
Any further questions?
I don't have any questions.
Okay. All right. Gentlemen, thank you, and thank you for your patience.
Thank you for staying with us late tonight.
Next witness, come on up here.
Yes. You need a little entertainment, Senator?
Well, you can either sit on the committee as a pro tem, or you can be a witness. Thank you again, gentlemen, for your time.
Well, I'm
thank
in the wrong committee, as usual. How are you, Ed?
Just fine, pro tem, Senator.
You got, this may be your only chance to get some of your stuff out of this committee, so you better...
Which committee is this?
This is the Judiciary Committee of the Oregon State Senate.
The problem, Senator, is I can't get my stuff out of the House Judiciary Committee to get it over here. I'm not worried once I get it over here.
Well, we are going to, just a minute, I think I just want to make a recitation on the record. That will close the public hearing on HB 2016, and we have just one bill left, don't we? 2007. And we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2007. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on House Bill 2007?
Which one is it, Senator?
Well, yes, Senator Fry, I thought I would. I mean,
2007. 2007.
Explain briefly what it is.
Are you on the committee?
I'm on the committee. I just tried calling you.
Oh, so Representative Campbell, you'd like this bill. It would, if an attorney causes a mistrial by messing around in the courtroom, why then he's going to have to pay the cost. Costs and disbursements may be assessed against the attorney who, because of deliberate misconduct, causes a mistrial. You remember that one over in the House?
I remember that
one. Okay. All right. Well, there's no...
I move the bill out, do pass.
No objection.
You want to testify on it?
No. Okay. Now the Senator's taking care.
Well, that's going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2007, then.
Let me take care of that bill.
Put your finger down there.
I talked to you about it.
If you called the roll, I would have answered for at least five people.
Have we got it yet?
Scheduled. It should be.
I think I could do Jeanette.
I don't know that we received it over here. The presentation bill, we got it yet.
It came in...
Just today.
Well, that's it for the public hearing.
Either early this morning or late yesterday afternoon.
We just got that in.
Yes. Yeah.
Just got it in. Okay. Listen, I'm telling you.
Are we going to have people coming?
We're all through. I've had public hearings on every bill on the agenda.
What? Which one is it?
Ready? You all done?
Yep, we're all done.
Shall we adjourn?
But then I can have my meeting with
all of the work Campbell. Session bills have been carried over till tomorrow. We will have a work session commencing at 1 p.m. tomorrow. We're not on a record run. We're off. We're all through. We're adjourned the meeting.
They'll just keep
okay. Yeah.
Which one was it? I've got three or four.
It's the grandparent.
Oh, the grandparent. Oh, absolutely.
What other bill do you want?